Well, good morning. Welcome to St. Andrew's. My name's Jason. If I haven't met you, I'm one of the pastors here, and it's really good to be with you today. As we get started in today's message, continuing this series on Galatians, I want to ask you a question. How many of you would be brave enough to admit in this room, in front of all your friends, that at some point you were insecure in a relationship? Some relationship, like some of you, maybe you went for a job that you thought, you know, I'm not good enough for this, but somehow you made it through the interview and you got the job, and then the first 90 days, every day, you're like, when are they going to find me out? I mean, just imposter syndrome, you know? Or if you, there was a girl, and you were like, man, I'm gonna ask her out. And she, by the sheer grace and miraculous power of God, said yes. And you go out, but like every time you're with, you're just thinking like, there is no way that I am going to be able to keep this up. Some of you married her. Like I don't know. It's clearer from this angle than maybe you know. But some of us got way out over our skis on that, right? And we live in this kind of insecurity about the relationship. And it's interesting, it's not just about the relationships with regular people, but like some of our closest ones. Like when Jessica and I first got married, we had just moved out of an apartment into our very first home. It was a small house, but it was going to be great. I was so excited to be able to kind of like live into the role of husband, man, provider, you know. But here's the problem, I'm not real handy. And never just didn't get blessed with that growing up. But my wife's father is the most handy person on the planet. Like Gary Ravis has a plumber's license, an electrical license, a general contractor's license. He can do anything. And so her whole life, they would be able to just call dad. And dad would fix whatever the problem was. And I'm thinking in our first, you know, year, like I got to be able to tell her she didn't have to call dad anymore. You got this. You know? So we move into our first house, and we decided to do the thing that if you are not married yet, or you're looking to be married one day, you really need to take this advice. Do not in the first 5 years try to hang pictures together. It is just, it's a bad move. Like there's nothing good that comes out of it. But we did it. We went ahead and dared to try. And so we're hanging this picture, and we knew we were going to have to put anchors in the wall, and it was going to require like some pilot holes to get drilled. And so I'm like, babe, I got this. Now, you also need to know, Jessica is an artist. Like, she welds. She can use power tools and things, right? So I'm already a little outmatched, and I'm feeling kind of insecure. But I get the drill, and it's just a simple pilot hole. And I start drilling, and nothing's really happening. And I push harder. And there's a little, you know, this is the best drywall in the world, apparently. And it's like some dust is kicking up. And she's like, hey, babe, I got this. We don't have to call dad. Where's Gary right now? And I'm good. And so I push a little harder. It's not working. The house was small. So I actually put my foot on the wall behind me. And I'm leaning with everything in, like just, I'm going to get this thing through. And I'm finally like, there's a stud on the other side. It's a pipe or something. And she's like, babe, the drill's in reverse. And in that moment, all of my, I'm like, shh, I've been found out, you know? And that's been the story of our marriage ever since. Just me not being able to live up to what I thought I was promising her. It's really bad when it's your wife. What's even worse is if you feel unworthy or insecure about the relationship with God. Right? This is something that we all deep down know is true of us. From the very beginning, humans have known that there's something in us that's broken, that's not worthy, that we can't be in relationship, and we are insecure. And so we try to do something about it. And that something that we try to do is called religion. And there's really only two religions in the world. Do you know this? There's just two. One is a religion of do, like D-O. You have to do stuff. And every religion except Christianity falls into this category. It is whether it's keep the five pillars of Islam, whether it's work your way through reincarnation back up to a certain acceptable stage, whether it's follow these rules, eat this stuff, celebrate this way, be this good, like how good are you? There's only two religions, that or done. Do versus done. And Christianity is unique. It stands unique in the universe as the only one that it's been done for you. This is what Paul's going to talk about in the passage of Scripture that we're looking at today, is how do we deal with this idea of being done? That whatever it is that we need to have security in our relationship with God, it's already been done. So we're going to be focusing on three verses in chapter 2 of Galatians. And we're kind of marching through this book little bit by little bit, and I hope you're reading along. But today we're going to be looking at verses 19 through 21. But just to catch you up, the few verses before that, what Paul says is he's talking to this group of people, some churches in the area of Galatia, modern-day Turkey, and they have come into contact with the good news of the gospel in Jesus, and they started out well, and then they started falling back into their old habits, trying to do religion. They've been working, they're adding stuff, and he's trying to tell them how insane this is. And so in the few verses before, he says, like, look, if anybody was going to be able to become good enough to really do this well enough, it would be us, the Jews. I mean, we got it all. We're the chosen ones. We have been given the moral law and, like, you know, the Ten Commandments. We got the ceremonial law. We got the civil law. We got everything handed to us. Like, if you want to be worthy of relationship with God, we got it spelled out for us. And guess what? We can't do it. And Jesus came along, and he decided to simplify it. And so he said this, love the Lord your God. If you want to be in relationship with God, here's how you do it. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, right? Love him with everything you got and love your neighbor as you love yourself. Super simple. How are we doing? Right? We know this. We can't do it. I mean, I've already failed in this in the last few minutes being up here. Just when I was thinking about how some of you married, you know, outside your punt coverage, and I was just kind of laughing inside. That was wrong. I've already sinned. This is just a vulnerable moment, okay? I just want to get it out there. But we fail this all the time. It's impossible. And so Paul says, let me tell you then what you're going to do. Because you can either choose to live life for the law, keeping the rules, or for God, but not both. And this is why what I'm about to tell you, if you will really let this into your heart, I mean, if you will really grasp it and spend time getting this simple but powerful truth of the gospel, your life will be more joyful, more peaceful, freer, less depression, less anxiety, less apathy. All this, if we get this truth down. Here's what he says. Because we can't live for the law, then in verse 19, he says, for through the law, I died to the law, so that I might live for God. I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I now live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me, listen to this, who loved me and gave himself for me. I do not set aside or I don't diminish. I don't underestimate the grace of God. For if righteousness could be gained through the law, Christ died for nothing. And this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Paul introduces two words in this passage that are kind of new to the way he's talking to the people. And I want to explain those two words because wrapped up in these two words are everything that we need to know about how to experience this freedom. The first word is right there in the last sentence. It's the word righteous, righteousness. What does righteous mean when you think about that word? Here in Southern California, there's a certain way of thinking about it, right? If you're kind of new to surfing, like I shouldn't even say that. I'm not new to surfing. I am not surfing. But I'm new to the idea of surfing, right? Can you imagine that? How long would the board have to be? In surf culture, this word righteous, and if you remember from Finding Nemo, Crush the turtle, you know, righteous, like there's an idea that like a wave could be righteous, or that's a righteous dude. It means that everybody wants to be around him. They're suitable for everyone. There's actually something called the Surfinary, like the Surf Dictionary. And if you want to, you can check it out. They have a list of all these words. It's incredible. And righteous would mean like, hey, we all want to be part of that. I'm able to be in relationship. I want to be in relationship with that guy. He's righteous. righteous in English has this idea of like behavior, good enough, right? Isn't that what you think of when you say, though, if I'm righteous or not? It means like, have I performed well? But in Greek and in the biblical mind, it actually doesn't mean just good enough. It means worthy of relationship. So it's like, I am good enough to be in relationship with. It's always a relational term. So this is why when Paul says that if there was righteousness, if I could be worthy of being in relationship with God through the law, then I would have already done this. Or I would recognize that it's impossible for me. So righteousness means, how do you make yourself secure? How do you get out of that insecurity of relationship with God? And this is a real dilemma. Because for God, it takes just two things. Moral perfection and purity. That's all you got to be. Just completely pure and absolutely moral. And we're all laughing, right? But we're kind of laughing a little nervously, especially if you're not yet a follower of Christ, because you know how difficult this is, and you know how scary and insecure this can make you feel. Because how good is good enough? What do you have to do for God to look at you and say, like, you qualify? Love him with all our heart, soul, mind, and our neighbor as ourself? Well, that just seems like a ridiculous proposition. So Paul says God has created the solution for us. That solution is a real fancy word, a real theological, technical word called justification. But let me explain to you what it means. It's pretty simple. Justification is the idea that at some point, this is like a legal term, at some point God declares you righteous. Declare. Like in a court of law, bang the gavel, you are now righteous. And everything about Christ, all of his goodness, his perfection, his purity, his moral upstanding, perfect obedience, all of that gets, and the word is imputed, reckoned, gets counted as yours in one moment. And at that moment, it's done forever. There's no double jeopardy in our justification. You know this term, right? If you can't be tried twice for a crime that you've already been acquitted of. And so in this way, Paul says, look, the only way that you can get secure in your relationship is for him to justify you on the basis of what Christ has done. So he says these words. We just read them, and they're kind of weird. He says, we've been crucified with Christ, and we don't even live any longer. What does that mean? What he's saying is, the law doesn't have power over us anymore. This demand for perfection, it doesn't have power over us anymore because God has actually already exacted the penalty for breaking it. He just did it through Christ. So when the perfect, sinless God of the universe put on human flesh and came and lived that life that way, and when he died, the law was satisfied. God's not going to wink and look away from all of the trouble and the evil and the failure that we've perpetrated. He doesn't let it just go. He deals with it, and he deals with it decisively. He just doesn't deal with it with you. So Christ, perfect and sinless, is put to death so that the penalty of sin can be paid. And then he's resurrected. And so Paul says, and now I live with him living through me. The old me, my old need to live up to this, my old performance, all of that, my old record is gone. And now, when God sees me, he sees me through Christ. Here's the problem. The fact that we don't really, really get this, and to the extent that you don't really believe this, you are trying to go backwards and live the Christian life, even though you might say, yeah, I know God has justified me because of Christ, you're still trying to earn it. And so you're doing all the activities, and you're doing all the stuff trying to be really more, like, totally focused on your behavior, and it's killing you. In his book, Spiritual Depression, Its Cure and Causes, Martin Lloyd-Jones talked about this, and he says this, he says, people like us, Christians who live this way, have not understood the way of salvation And so for that reason, all their beliefs and efforts have been more or less useless. They concentrate so hard on the question of sanctification, or the idea of like living out this faith, right? Looking like Jesus, being holy. They focus so hard on that, but it doesn't help because they didn't understand justification. So let me tell you how this applies in your real life. Two things that justification, a good grasp of justification by faith. You are made righteous because of God. Here's how it applies to your life. The first thing it does is it makes us secure. It takes the insecurity and it removes it and it makes you secure. Secure in relationships, secure with God. Think about how often insecurity makes us fearful. Imagine living a life where you didn't have to protect, preserve, or produce. One of the things that happens to us when we're real insecure with God is we live in these between these two ditches and we keep falling into them. One of them is like, because I'm not secure, I get real judgmental, I can be like bold, but the boldness turns into arrogance. Like, I'm better than you. I've got to always judge me compared to the other people. And so we look and we're like, yeah, I don't have your sin. So, you know, I'm here and you're here. And we get super self-righteous. Or we realize just how much we're constantly failing God and we think we're disappointing him. We fall in the other ditch, which is not humility. It's like self-loathing. It's we become very spineless and just like cowering. And the gospel says, justification says, you can be bold without being arrogant, and you can be humble without being spineless. You actually are free to just live this life the way that God intended, led by the Spirit towards love, because the law's not messing with you anymore. You're free. So we can find that we're made more secure, and my friend Steve Carter, who preached here this summer, says it like this, that we can have nothing to lose, nothing to prove, and nothing to hide. Wouldn't that be an amazing way to go through life? Like some of you who are in school still, like if you're in middle school or you're in high school, like this sounds like a breath of fresh. Can you imagine walking through 10th grade and feeling like you have nothing to prove, nothing to lose, and nothing to hide? For those of us that can recall what that time in life felt like, that was all you thought about. If I sit at the wrong table, if I don't have this score, if I go out with the wrong person, if I get put in this group versus this group, I am constantly going to be judged, right? I'm going to lose the worthiness of someone being in relationship with me. I have everything to lose. I have everything to prove. And I got to hide any flaws. So we make our social media accounts or whatever else that we put out to the world as our personal faith, we make it look perfect. Imagine the freedom of knowing you are so secure in your relationship that you have none of that. Paul says it's because you've been crucified with Christ, nothing left to lose. He lives through you, nothing to prove. You've justified by him, nothing to hide. Completely free. And then you can kind of live life and do what you do with God without trying to earn something. Tim Keller has this great illustration for this that I think will help. He says it like this. Imagine that you have a great Aunt Matilda and she's fabulously wealthy. And you know, he's from New York, so she lives Upper East Side, Manhattan, and you live with her. And Matilda has no children of her own, no biological kids. So you live in the house and you just do stuff to help her out, you know? You take her to her appointments, you make sure medicine's there, you rub her bunions and, you know, all that. Like what you would do with a fabulously wealthy great aunt Matilda. And you do this and neither of you are sure why you're doing it. Like you're not sure if you're doing this because you love Matilda or because she's got $100 million estate and no children. And she's not sure if you're doing it because you love her or if you're just on the make, you know? The only way that you can kind of settle this and you can be secure in knowing why you even do what you do is if she settles the issue of the will. Like if one day she comes to you and she's like, it's done. I've made you the primary and sole beneficiary of all of my wealth. I executed it. I gave it to the attorney. It's in the lockbox. It is over. You have everything that's mine. Now what happens? Do you stop taking her to appointments and rubbing her bunions? Is this like too fresh for some of you? Right? I mean, do you stop all those things? No. But why do you do them now? It's not to get the money. The money is yours. Everything she has, it's yours, done once and for all. The reason you do it now is out of glad response to this grace that she's shown you, this incredible thing she's given you. You'll take her wherever she needs to go for the rest of her life, because it's all yours. You're secure. Same with Christ. This is why in a few weeks we're going to start talking about behavior. And the reason some of you are like, why do we keep talking about this same thing? It's so basic. Justification by faith. This is basic. Do you know why? Because we forget. In fact, Martin Luther said it like this: most necessary it is, therefore, that we should know this well, this justification by faith. So teach it unto others and beat it into their heads continually. Isn't that great? That sounds like a German guy, right? Just beat it into their heads. That's why I keep talking to you about this. Because if we jump to the rest of this book where Paul says, and now this is the way that you're going to live, and this is the way that you're going to love, and this is how people are going to... If we jump to that right now and you didn't have this down, you will do it all for the wrong reason, and you'll be even more insecure. You got to get this. And once you do, it sets you free. It makes you secure. But secondly, it also helps you reinterpret suffering. The ability to understand you've been justified by faith lets you reinterpret the suffering you experience. See, until we get it, whenever suffering comes, our first thought is, God's mad at me. What did I do wrong? What do I have to learn from this? Anybody ever felt that before? And you can't quite grasp, like, you know intellectually that God loves you and approves of you, but somehow this outside circumstance feels like he's doing it to punish me. Or the other side is that when you get suffering, you just get mad at God and write him off. Hey, I don't deserve this. Look at everything I've done for you. In fact, do you remember in the book of Job? It's kind of an interesting little picture of that. Job, this great guy, and everything starts to happen that he loses, like everything. And some of his friends come to him, and they say it the first way. They're like, Job, bro, what'd you do wrong? And he goes, I've done absolutely nothing wrong. I am very righteous. He maybe had a little bit of inflated ego, but that's for another time. But he's like, no, I didn't do anything to cause this. And his wife, she takes the other side. You remember what she says? Curse God and die, old man. Like, God's left you. He's forgotten about you. A good grasp of your justification by faith lets you go through suffering saying, it's not that God's mad at me, it's not that God's left me, it's that I am, in Paul's words, participating in the sufferings of Christ for my good and his glory. I live in a fallen world, but it will not stay that way. One day God will make everything right. From atrocities in Israel to homelessness on our streets to all the problems of justice that you see and feel to you and around you, one day they'll all be made right, but they are not God's punishment for you. He has not forgotten you. And this is what the justification of faith can do. The problem is self-righteousness. Does anybody like self-righteous? When you see a person that's self-righteous, isn't that just the worst? Smug and judgmental and cynical. We hate self-righteous people. Until it's us. Until we start falling into that trap. And if you're relying on your own righteousness, not only are you missing out on joy and security and purpose, but you might just be missing out on the whole gospel. The reason I say this is because Jesus told a parable about it one time, and it goes like this. It's in Matthew 22. He's talking about, and you're going to see in this parable, it won't take long, but you're going to see all of the stuff Paul's been talking about. You're going to see the Jews, and you're going to see the Gentiles, the rest of us. You're going to see people trying to justify themselves, and you're going to see righteousness. And Jesus just makes it really, really clear with this story. He says, Jesus spoke to them one day and said, the kingdom of heaven is like a king that prepared a wedding banquet for his son. He sent his servants to those who'd been invited to the banquet to tell them to come, but they refused. Then he sent some more servants, and he said, tell those who've been invited that I have prepared my dinner. Now, a wedding banquet at this time is a deal. It is an event. It would last a week. It is the place that you wanted to be at. Everyone who would get invited to a wedding by a king is showing up. He said, tell those that invited, I've prepared my dinner. The oxen and the fattened cattle have been butchered. Everything is ready. Just come to the wedding banquet. And that's a picture of the call of God to the Jews to be in, to be his people. It says, but they paid no attention. They went off, one to his field, another to his business. They were too busy trying to justify themselves, be good enough, smart enough, wealthy enough, pretty enough, useful enough. Self-righteousness. The rest seized his servants, mistreated them, and killed them. And that's kind of like what happened with the prophets that God would send. And so the king's enraged. He sent his army and destroyed those murderers, and he burned their city. And that's a picture of what happened in Jerusalem in AD 70. It's radical. And then he said to the servants, you know what? The wedding banquet is ready, but those I invited didn't deserve to come because they tried to deserve it themselves. So go to the street corners and invite to the banquet anyone that you find. And look at this. So the servants went out in the streets and they gathered all the people they could find, the bad as well as the good. And the wedding hall was filled with guests, the bad and the good. But when the king came in to see the guests, he noticed a man there who wasn't wearing wedding clothes. Now, what does that mean? In this time, if you threw one of these monster parties, people that would come into that place would come from all different places in life, right? You might have some friends that were wealthy and some that were poor. You might have some that had a good background, heritage, name, ethnicity, and others who didn't have that. Some who worked and some who were people of leisure. And in the party, if you didn't do something, everyone would kind of stay in their class and in their situation. And there was division, and so a king or a host of a party would give everyone a robe, and the robes were all nondescript, and they looked exactly alike. And so when you came to that, you put on the robe so that you could talk to anyone because we're all equal at this party. So he finds a guy who's sitting in the wedding, he doesn't have on the robe. He's wearing his own clothes. He's made his own way. He's trying to earn or deserve or show that he should have this invitation himself. It's self-righteousness. When the king came in to see him, he noticed him and he said, how'd you get in here without wedding clothes, friend? And says the man was speechless. I don't think it's because he didn't know what to say. I think because in that moment, he recognized the truth that you and I have to come to as well, that on our own, with our best, we are not worthy of the banquet. But the invitation and the robe of righteousness has been offered to us. So the king told the attendants, tie him hand and foot and throw him outside in the darkness where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth, for many are invited, but few are chosen. Folks, the invitation to God's great banquet of eternity with him, of forgiveness of sin, of freedom in Christ, the invitation has been given to you. It's been delivered. The question is, are you still trying to argue with why you deserve to have gotten the invitation in the first place? Or are you just grateful that God has done this on your behalf? See, when we come really, really face to face with this concept, that although we've all been, well, let's just use a modern culture where we've all been canceled, spiritually canceled. There's no way back. You can't undo it. God has said, but I am allowing you through grace, through your simple trust and faith in Christ, I am allowing you to be made worthy of relationship with me again, righteous, and you got nothing to fear. So can I just ask you this? Do you find yourself kind of tired, maybe apathetic a little bit about your faith? Do you find maybe there's that low level of guilt or insecurity Have you had the thought that when the bad thing comes, like God's just punishing you? Or why do I even bother? If so, it's a clue that you need to just focus, concentrate, let this idea, this concept of justification by faith permeate your soul. Because on the other side of that is freedom, security, and joy. Charles Wesley, I close with this, great hymn writer. A lot of the things that we've sung in our lifetime were written by him. But at one point, he was a missionary before he became a writer. And he was, in 1738, he's on his, what he thinks is his deathbed. He's like really, really sick. And the pastor comes by and he says, "Charles, do you have hope? You have hope for salvation?" And he goes, "Absolutely, I do." Pastor says, "Where's your hope coming from?" And he's like, "All my endeavors for God. I did a lot of stuff for him. I went to the path on Wednesday night together. I volunteered in the nursery. I tithed. I showed up when the doors were open. I did a lot of good things for him." And the pastor just dropped his head and walked out. And in the autobiography, Charles Wesley said that he was absolutely torn apart by that. What in the world? God's not going to view? Is he not counting all the great things I've done for him? And he tells that the next week, a guy named John Bray showed up at his door with Luther's commentary on Galatians. And he read it to him, and in fact, he said this thing about it exactly. He says, "I spent some hours this evening in private with Martin Luther, who was greatly blessed to me, especially his conclusion of the second chapter, the verses we read. I labored, waited, and prayed to feel who loved me and gave himself up for me." He said, "The power is in the pronouns. The God of the universe loved me and gave himself up for me." So before you walk out of this room today, I want you to have a chance to experience that. So I'm going to ask if you're able, wherever you are, just close your eyes. Just try to get the distractions out. And I just want to have you think about this for a second. I want you to consider how in the world the God of the universe thought you were worth giving himself up for you and dying for you. You know your stuff. I don't have to know it. You know it. How in the world did Christ decide that you were worth the price that he would pay? What kind of love must he have for you? What kind of joy must he have when you say yes to the invitation? As you ponder that, look, this is not about us just puffing ourselves up. Far from it. It's a sober realization that everything that we have and do, we have because God initiated by his grace, including the security that you want and the joy that he says is possible. So, Father, I ask that you would make this really true for us. Like, take this idea that we are made worthy of relationship, made righteous by Christ, and just tattoo it on our hearts. Would you emblazon it on our souls? God, for my friends in the room that they're still in the religion of do, whatever it looks like, still trying hard, still working hard, still wondering how good is good enough. God, I ask that you would set them free today and that they would know that it's already been done. If that's where you are, like you're tired and that's you've been trying that through whatever religion or non-religion, I just want you to know, like, all you have to do at this moment is just say, "God, I trust that Jesus is your son who lived, died, and was resurrected. I place my faith in that. That your declaration that I am now righteous is enough. Father, I pray that you would give us St. Andrews. Make us into a community of faith, a body of believers that lives with this kind of freedom, that loves because of what is true of us, not to try to make it true. I pray that you would make us known in our workplaces and homes and community for the way that we recklessly love, because we've already got it all. The will's been executed. It's locked away. Done deal. We have everything because we have you. And set us free from ourselves and from our striving. Jesus, would you give us the joy that is part of that freedom? And we pray this in your name. Amen.